If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56diva.com. Lower.com, Equal Housing Lender, MLS 112-4061.
Group called themselves the Cars, and the song was called Drive. Well, that's perfect. If you're going to talk to Tom Appel, and guess what? We are. Hey, Tom, how are you doing?
I am well. Thank you, John.
And I want to make everyone perfectly clear that Tom will be appearing with Steve and Johnny in the wee hours of when, Tom?
Saturday evening into Sunday morning at midnight.
Unbelievable. You are dedicated, as are they. He gets to drive.
Yes, they are.
Doesn't Steve get to test? He used to be able to test drive cars. Does he still get that? Does he still get to do that? Do you know?
I think they do less of it than they used to. I just think they've been busy writing books and such. But yeah, they were regular test drivers in a local suite.
Not bad. So, we've got the new 2025 New York Auto Show. You've got the list of the biggest gas guzzlers of the 90s. You've got automotive design. Where would you like to start, and where would you like to take us, Tom?
I would love to talk about the automotive design article. If we're talking about the Lexus SC article, yeah. It's a personal favorite.
Go right ahead.
This is such a strange period in the evolution of American luxury. Lexus came in at the end of the 80s, towards the early 90s, and kind of changed things. They were selling vehicles that were very comparable to Mercedes-Benz vehicles, but they were so much cheaper. And yet the vehicles weren't compromised. They were nice cars. And at first they launched with two sedans. One of them wasn't very interesting. The other one was a bigger VA-powered car, and it kind of put Lexus on the map. But a couple of years later, they built this beautiful coupe that I don't think very many people remember called the SC. There was an SC300 and an SC400. And what's so special about this car is that it's one of the last cars of the modern era that still had thin pillars, thin side pillars, thin back pillars. And the car just looks light and it looks pretty and it was very sporty. And it was just this fantastic Lexus. It was a great third car for the brand. And it was... affordable is the wrong word, but it was less than a comparable Mercedes would have been.
Affordable, quote unquote, being what, 45, 55, 60 grand, something in there?
At the time, probably 45. Yeah, John, yeah. It's probably right around there.
Yeah, I know those prices because I could never afford them. That's how I know them. I mean, you know, like a lot of us are like, wow, look at that great car. Can't afford that. No, I guess not. Yeah, I see a picture of the Lexus SC300 that you sent, and I've seen that car. Not a lot, to be be truthful, but it's like you say, it has very clean lines, don't you say? Would that be one way of?
Yeah, it's clean. I think it looks agile and light. Also, they're a little bit rare now, and there is a market for them. There are people who would buy these used, so they're not. They're not like you can find a used affordable one. That's
right.
Unless it's trash, there's probably someone looking for the same car and probably willing to pay a little money for it.
Speaking of paying a little money for it, what's the tariff situation now with the auto industry?
The tariff situation is really confusing and difficult to stay on top of. But two things going on here. We've learned that to some extent the tariffs aren't as extreme as we thought. They're now based on the gap between American content and the price of the car, not the whole price of the car. So that is bringing down the prices somewhat. And we have manufacturers assuring us that they're not going to raise prices through certain dates. And Ford just extended that date, I think, through July. And one of the very interesting things is that manufacturers are in the background still making plans for the future. So I think there's a lot of finger crossing that this is going to go away in the short term or the midterm because it is very disruptive. And the average prices of cars are going up, and Ford can promise that it won't raise the price of cars, but that doesn't mean that their dealers need to comply. Mm. And if it does end up being a shortage of vehicles, we will see prices rise. And in fact, this year, I think per Cox Automotive, the average transaction price on a new car has slowly risen from $48,000 to $51,000. So prices are climbing slowly.
The thing about the automotive industry, which I'm not that well informed, but I'm pretty sure I've known for quite a while, that the idea of, quote unquote, building a completely 100 American automobile as parts, you know, top to bottom, doesn't exist. And that if not the entire car, or but some parts are brought in from Canada. And we all know where Trump is with Canada as far as the tariffs are concerned. So, like, if it was a part that came from Canada, not a car, this sounds like a ridiculous conversation, and maybe it is. They put a tariff on the part?
Yes.
What?
Yes. One of the things that we learned, and I'm not entirely sure how this layering works, but at the moment, the U.S. government is not doubling up on taxes. So that means that American manufacturers aren't paying tax on the imported part plus the tax on raw materials, which is steel and aluminum. Mm-hmm. So that's good. They're not doubling up there. But, yeah, the problem is that parts come from Canada and Mexico for a reason. They were more expensive to build there. And it's that price advantage that allowed us in the U.S. to enjoy relatively affordable cars at the low end of the market. And Nissan has stopped importing, unfortunately, three of its vehicles, the Kicks, the Versa, and the Sentra, from Mexico at the moment because the tariff makes those cars unsellable in the U.S., unfortunately. And those were the most affordable vehicles in the maker's lineup.
I have a question.
Please do.
Now, this is all supposed to, at the end of the day, lead to building new plants and making more cars for sale in the American market because they're built in the American market. Okay. One, how many years does it take to start constructing a new car manufacturing plant? And the second part of the question is, how many people does a car plant of the 21st century mean get hired, as opposed to a plant that was built in the any time before the year 2010? Is this the goal of the tariffs, at least as the automotive industry goes? Is this realistic?
Not in the short term, and possibly not in the midterm. And you make two great points. Manufacturing plants do not employ as many people as they used to, and that's just because of automation. And to move a plant, say, from Mexico to the U.S. would mean locating a greenfield site, building a plant, and then getting the run built up. And even after you've done that, usually your first season, you don't build that many of the cars because you want it to be a slow ramp up for quality reasons. And that process can take 3, 4, 5, even 6 years, depending on the vehicle. So we would not see the impact very soon. And regarding labor, we've seen that with battery plants, for example, and we are going electric at some point. It's just been slower than we expected. Battery plants hire very few people. They're highly automated, and we can put plants in the U.S., and I guess that's good for a bunch of reasons, but it's not going to have a huge impact on employment.
So why then is the UAW backing it?
The UAW believes that we'll be making more cars here as opposed to bringing them in from Canada. The Canadian Union Unifor and the UAW don't play that nicely, and they're jealous of the people's of each other's jobs. But
that explains a lot.
The potential here for new employment is not that high. And one of the things that manufacturers have been slow to do in the last decade, especially since the Great Recession, is to add capacity. Because capacity is really an obligation to build a lot more cars. And the Americans have not been consuming more cars annually for a while now. We've been stuck at about 16, 15 million units a year. So there isn't a lot of growth here. So building factories is a dicey proposition.
We're going to do more with Tom when we come back on 720 WGN. Cars. You know, everybody loves cars, man. I mean, come on. 720 WGN. Don't you love cars? Who doesn't like an automobile? We had a love affair with the automobile. It's like
Oldsmobile 442.
Come on.
It's Buick Riviera.
Cars are the best, man. They're the absolute best.
Roadrunner.
I love driving them. All right. Tom Appel is with us. So we were talking about, I'm going to shift gears, no pun intended. Let me see, where was I shifting my gears to? So we were discussing the tariffs and the price of the new car, et cetera, et cetera. Hypothetically speaking, what does that do to the used car market?
If there is indeed a shortage of new cars, we will see used car prices rise. And that's exactly what we saw during the chip shortage in the aftermath of the COVID crisis.
Yes, yeah.
And that was a big deal. And used car prices went through the roof, making cars very inaccessible for people with modest budgets.
So
I think the number was on average for used, $40,000?
Really?
Yeah,
I remember that whole chip
thing. Correct me if I'm wrong, Tom. I think it was about $40,000, $45,000.
Wasn't there a whole thing, too? Correct me if I'm wrong, that there were freighters and backed up outside of ports in Los Angeles that couldn't come in because there were so many of them and they contained.
Yeah, there was when things got going again, there was a big backlog at ports.
Yeah.
You're not crazy.
And the idea
was not that crazy.
And the idea was, well, let's make them here, wasn't it? I mean, if we're going to get chips.
The last thing that was done on that subject was by the Biden administration. It was called the CHIP Act.
Right. Okay, well, let's forget that for right now. So, Tom, do you want to talk about the 2025 New York Auto Show at all?
We can, a couple of big announcements there.
Yeah, please.
One of the most interesting, there's a controversy coming out of New York, actually. And you wouldn't think that this company would be involved in controversy, but Subaru showed a couple of new vehicles in New York, but the big deal was at the Outback, a car that is beloved by Americans and people who love Subaru, and lots of people like Subaru. It's a very, very, very dedicated fan base. The Outback for 2026 no longer looks like a station wagon. And this is making big news because that has been the thing. And what's so crazy about it is that Subaru has been the only company that's been able to sell a station wagon like in the last 20 years. But here it is. People love the Outback. They sell 150,000 of them a year.
Yeah.
So there's people who want that. But the new one looks more like a crossover. And it does have some people alarmed.
What if it's not broke, don't fix it. Why would they change a very popular model design?
That's a good question. I don't have an answer for you. And I can only assume that Subaru, a company that makes almost no mistakes, they seem to know their audience really well, that maybe they know that their audience wants their car to look a little bit more like a crossover. Also, they might be trying to expand the market, and it's possible that they're kind of locked into a certain core group and not a lot of other people, so this is their big chance to see if they can bring in a bigger audience.
I have another question for you, Tom.
Yes.
Is the stick shift a thing of the past?
Not at my house.
Yes.
It is? Yeah. Really?
Yeah, stick is dead. And fewer and fewer makers incorporate stick into their cars. And one of the things is sort of a self-defeating cycle here is that as manufacturers order fewer manual transmissions, fewer suppliers are able to build them or distribute them. But more so, and this is important, we don't need manual transmissions for electric cars. Manual transmissions are kind of weird in hybrid vehicles, which are very popular now. And then a lot of driver assistance systems, advanced driver assistance systems that we sometimes call ADAS, do not work well with stick. So obstacle detection, automatic braking, and adaptive cruise control, they don't work well with stick. So that's a lot of the reason. The other reason is that nobody wants it.
Now, wait a minute.
There are some of us that appreciate a stick. Trust me.
Oh, me too.
And the thing is, also, for some of us, it's like, you know what? Looking at the younger generations that have gotten a little crazy and decided that, oh, yeah, let's go carjack someone. Okay, there are three pedals on the floor and this thing next to you on the right that moves. Do you know what they do? Can you drive it? No? Good. So go away. Bother somebody else, okay?
I mean, years and years ago, of course, before automatic transmission even, there was something they called three on a tree.
That's right.
But I had like sports cars, like Triumph Spitfire.
I had a 350Z Roadster.
You're right.
Six speed.
Exactly.
Loved it.
this was a driving experience, so to speak, if you will. It was looked like a roller skate, but it was about as big as one. But I mean, you had Triumph Spitfires and Mazda Miatas, which I think Mazda Miata still makes a stick, if I'm not mistaken.
Mazda does, yep.
Yeah. Mitsubishi yep. had one. It was, I think, the 3000 GT.
And I have a stick on a Honda.
And that was a hot-looking car.
I had have a stick on a Honda Fit Sport from 2018. And I had a friend of mine who was running a Honda dealership, and he had to go looking for it because I was like,
I want a stick. Darn it. Get me a stick.
Yes. Well, one thing about stick shifts, and we'll get off the subject, was that they had better gas mileage than automatics. And now, speaking of gas mileage, he said, segueing, Tom, you've got this article about gas guzzlers and the 10 worst gas guzzlers of 1994. And the thing that amazed me, first of all, was that as recently as 1994, cars were getting this kind of gas mileage. It just seemed like wow, that seems to me relatively recent, considering everything and these numbers. No one would buy it.
Yeah, there's some cars that are still in the American portfolio that were still powered by V8s. It's kind of the end of that era. Mm-hmm. But yeah, some of this fuel economy was tragic, and this is the fuel economy that we saw with cars that we took in through the office. So these are official test vehicles.
Right. What'd you get?
So,
you don't have to go through all of them.
Chevy Camaro Z28, 13.2 MPG. I will suggest to you, I didn't know the crew then just yet, but I suspect that they weren't easy on that car.
Right. Of course not. You don't get one of those cars and then go, I think I'm going to drive very conservatively to save on gas. No way. And waste that V8 or whatever you got under the hood there? Come on.
Yep, yeah. And that one was a manual. That was a 5-speed manual.
Yeah, yeah. I got some of them I think you would almost, maybe not. I mean, a Lincoln Mark 8, 14.9. I mean, you got a bunch of cars here that are in the 14 to 16
mile per hour
range.
About that Lincoln Mark 8, I got one of those as a test car.
Listen to you.
Trust me, when you put your foot down, it went.
Oh, yeah.
Very fast.
Yes.
It growled.
Well, that's
that was that was a bunch of engine. That was the Lincoln, the Ford Intech V8, 4.6 liter V8, close to 300 horsepower, and it did make that car move out.
Oh, it was. But the best, I think, in that time frame, Audi had some four-door sedans.
Listen to you,
back in the day.
My.
And they had, and they were stick. And,
really?
Oh, yes. And trust me, if you were doing 80 and you just kept it there consistent, the needle didn't move on the gas gauge. For a couple of hours, easily.
Just to state the facts, if you want to get in a car today and you want to feel an unbelievable amount of acceleration immediately,
you get an EV.
You get a Tesla. It'll throw you, your head will be thrown against the headrest.
Any EV with two motors will scare you.
Truly. Anyway, Tom,
one of the best kept secrets, really, of the EV world is that,
really?
Especially the dual motors, as you noted, is that EVs are just so incredibly fast in most applications, and
unbelievable.
I think it's a huge selling point. And the power is so smooth;
they will beat supercars and hypercars in a short run, easily.
I mean, we digress.
Yes.
I've got a couple of minutes left, Tom. Is there anything you want to add up now that we've grab most of your time?
There's something very interesting coming up that we're going to be talking more about in the news, I think, and that's the fact that the federal government is approving the distribution of E15. In Chicago, most of the gas that we buy is E10, which means it's 10% ethanol, 90% gasoline. But to stretch the gas supply and to bring gas prices down, I guess, we're going to be seeing some E15 I don't know how much we're going to see of it in Illinois, but it's been nationally approved. And there is some concern about alcohol's impact on the fuel system, and that's not unfounded. The cars are designed to run on E10. There is some, you know, allowance there for variation in the fuel, but we'll be hearing more about that soon.
All right, Tom. Oh, and we'll be hearing more from Tom this weekend, Saturday into Sunday, just around the midnight hour or before and after with Steve and Johnny. So we'll be tuning in for that. Thank you for being with us, Tom. Really appreciate it.
Oh, pleasure is mine. Thank you, John.
You betcha. Tom Appel, publisher of Consumer Guide Automotive. Needless to say, he knows his stuff.